Good evening, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Patrick. By the grace of God and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, and I guess she has to say those nice things about me. Like she said, we're engaged to be married, you know? And sorry to the home group members who have to hear me at least once a year around here. I wasn't even her first choice tonight. Her original speaker fell through, so I guess that's what happens when your wife has a home group and her speaker falls through. But anyway, I'm really glad to be here. I thought one of my good friends, you know, let me start by saying this. If I talk about the book, that's the program of action. That's just fact. If I say anything else, it's my opinion that's based on experience. A lot of my opinion and my experience come from those who I've learned and my teachers that have come before me. So a lot of what I'm about to say up here, it really isn't original tonight. I thought that one of my favorite teachers was going to be here, and, you know, he has these famous one-liners, you know, like... And he's the guy that tells me no is a complete sentence, you know. And he tells me there's no such thing as a coincidence, that his definition of a coincidence is God remaining anonymous during a miracle. And there's certain things this week in recovery that happen to be on my heart. And when her speaker falls through less than 24 hours ago, I have to come up here and talk about those things tonight. I'm going to try to tie it together. Those who know me, you know that I am, we laugh. I'm not a long story short kind of guy. I don't know how to tell my experience, strength, and hope in a half hour and leave time for you guys to share, but I'm going to try to tie it all together with a couple of bullet points. Before I get started, I really want to congratulate Teresa. You know, Teresa's my fiance's sponsor, you know, and it's because of women like her with integrity that have raised women like her in Alcoholics Anonymous to become the people they are. It's funny, Teresa got sober 11 years ago at the exact same time as my sponsor, and they had a small big book study that took place out of his house. She could tell you more of those details, but they were students back then to become teachers for people like her, and my sponsor to become a teacher like me. That meeting has now grown into a large meeting of over 100 people, and 4 years later, you know, I'll tell you that my sobriety date is August 4th of 2012. So 4 years ago, that's where the miracle happened for me. And now I'm blessed and able to be a teacher in that room. I sit at a microphone every Monday night in front of a room full of 100 or so people. And my message up there is easy. I don't get it nervous. My heart doesn't beat any faster because I have a book in front of me, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We take one or two pages and we talk for it on those one or two pages for an hour. So believe me, I can talk for an hour on that much condensed material. So when you asked me to get up here tonight and just tell you what it was like, what happened and what it's like now, and tie in the experience with the solution in a half hour, I have to leave it up to God. I don't know where we're going to go with that, you know. You know, what's on my heart today, you know, and listen, everybody introduced themselves as addict. I can identify as well also. I was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous to limit my discussion to alcohol, but I want to start by saying this, that whatever it is that you do that you can't stop doing that has you here tonight, let me be the first to tell you that the solution is exactly the same. So when I say the word alcohol, please replace that word with whatever it is you do that you can't stop doing that has you here tonight. Alcoholics Anonymous found me. I chose another fellowship when I first started this journey a long, long time ago. I'm not going to knock that fellowship. I have no ill will or resentment towards it, even if I was ready. I wasn't ready, even if there was a teacher in those rooms for me, okay? I had given up all hope on any fellowship. I don't care what you put in front of that last A, you know, N-A-A-A, whatever you want to call it. I wasn't ready. When I had lost all hope, Alcoholics Anonymous found me. You know... 4 years into sobriety, and I'm sure like many of you people that have a little bit of time in sobriety, you're given a life, like Teresa said, beyond, I have been given a life beyond my wildest dreams. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like. Now, let me skip to the punchline. I have every single thing imaginable that I want and more than what I need, externally and internally. And I am still a student of this work. And I believe that there is more to be accomplished internally. So I don't stand up here. I'm going to do my best, let me tell you, to not stand up here on a soapbox and tell you that my way is the only way. I'm not a spokesperson for Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? This is just my experience. And, you know, a lot of times because we get busy, I get busy, and I think my mind will tell me what's most important out there. And usually it's external stuff. Right? And something will smack me in the face really quickly and knock me back down the sides and tell me that I have nothing if I don't have sobriety. and the God that has come, that has allowed me to have that sobriety. And this week, we hear about a lot of people that lose their lives to the disease of addiction. And this past week, I've lost two unique cases that are pretty close to me. It makes no sense, okay? There's a lot going on out there, but this thing doesn't discriminate. Just by a show of hands, how many people know somebody who has died directly as a result of drug or alcohol use? That is literally the entire room. I saw you raise your hand. You're the person I'm up here for. There's guys in this room with decades of sobriety. I look up to them very, very much so. But my message is for the newcomer who has no hope and doesn't know that a solution exists, okay? An 18-year-old kid I met 2 years ago when he moved from a white picket fence, upper-class neighborhood in Long Island down to South Florida, you know, 18 years old, man. Relapsed. Part of my home group, parents, watched his parents come from Long Island to pick up a one-year medallion, and I just got news earlier in the week that this kid passed away. Why him? And then the exact opposite end of the coin, you know, first time around at recovery, relapses, picks one up, gone. And then I have a guy that's worked for me, he's 56 years old, the exact opposite end of the coin, the exact opposite end of this spectrum. 25 years this man's been in Alcoholics Anonymous, okay, and I don't think he's put one consecutive year of sobriety together. The hopeless case, and this man has been in, I sat next to him 12 hours a day, every day of my life for the past 2 years, and you know, at least this man got to die with some dignity, but it was in a hospital, not in a crack house, which is where I really believed I was going to lose him a long time ago on these runs, but a direct result of complications of his health due to the fact that he wasn't able to share in the gift of sobriety that I have up here tonight, right? So I take this thing seriously. So let's just give that disclaimer. And the question that I have, one of my favorite speakers out there, he says, we're inches and seconds away from death or prison. And he says, I mean that quite literally. And I can relate to it. My life is categorized by inches or seconds in one direction or the other, and I would not be standing here talking to you guys tonight. And I ask you, as I share it tonight, does that apply to you? If you were in 2 feet to the left or 2 feet to the right or 2 minutes earlier or 2 minutes later, do you think you'd be in this room tonight? Because I know that I wouldn't be in this room tonight. And so why are we here? Why is Teresa picking up 11 years? I'm sure she'd be the first to agree with me with that statement. Like, why her? So I don't know. I that's what's on my heart here tonight. You know, like, why are we the lucky ones? And I don't think that I'm the lucky one because I have 4 years. I think you're the lucky one because you just happen to be here tonight, you know? And there is a solution out there, and that's what I want to get to. I mean, I'll tell you a little bit about myself. You know, I grew up in, and I'm just going to give you a quick bullet point, and we'll get to the solution. I'll tell you what kind of kid I was. I grew up in a middle class at best town in New Jersey, not too far from Jersey City. You know, I have two parents. My parents are still together. My parents love me. The bottom line is that I just didn't, you know, I have that missing thing inside of me, right, that I didn't really fit in. Even though nothing was wrong, I was pretty good at sports. I fit in. The girls kind of liked me. Something just wasn't right inside of me. You know, I learned from this woman just recently, right? She studied Carl Jung's work, right? And Carl Jung is the person that we talk about in There Is a Solution. And, you know, you know, he says that the Latin root word of the word alcohol comes from, the root word of alcohol comes from the Latin word spirit. And there's two definitions of spirit. And one of them is the alcohol, the liquor that we actually take. The other one is the Holy Spirit, the God that is inside of us. And Carl Jung thinks that we got it backwards as alcoholics, that we had reached for the bottle, the spirit, rather than the solution, which has been inside all of us from day one, right? And I believe at 14 years old, 13 years old, the uncomfortability that was going on inside of me that felt like I didn't fit in, even when I really fit in, allowed me to reach for that bottle, and that alcohol was my solution, and it continued to be my solution for a really long time. The book talks about, you know, some of us cross that line from heavy, hard drinking into alcoholism. I believe the first time I took a drink, I was an alcoholic. I was bodily different from every single person that I drank around. I didn't stop drinking from the time I was 13 years old. By 14, I progressed. I got arrested for a possession of marijuana charge, right? And I'm going to tell these stories because this is a bullet in my life. The bullet in my life is that at 14 years old, I had gotten arrested. It wasn't that big of a deal. A little league coach was like the arresting officer, whatever the case may be. They showed me a Polaroid picture. They tried to scare me. They showed me a Polaroid picture of a girl who had just overdosed from heroin. She was dead. She was blue. It was like shock value. That's what the message was from the police, right? And I tell you this because as I read the book with a qualified sponsor many 20 years later, you know, I realized ominous warning, which I failed to heed. The warning signs were on the wall for a guy like me. They were operative from the very beginning is the way that Bill W. put it. Those police officers, my parents, those teachers, everybody that was in my life at that time couldn't have told me that I had a problem that this girl was going to have. Fast forward to 26 years old, that's how old I was, the first time I stepped foot in the state of Florida with the same problem that girl had, except I was alive. They were all right. What happened at 14 years old, that was the summer going into my freshman year of high school. My parents, they decided that I was, you know, going to get in some type of a trouble. They had to get me out of my public school system. They shipped me off to another town. Grandma ponied up the money and off I went to this private school. Like I said, I'm from a middle class at best town, so it was a little bit different for me. These kids all had money. They were rich. I didn't know anything about this lifestyle. Once again in my life, I just didn't fit in. So drugs and alcohol was how I fit in. That's what I brought to the table. And I made a host of fair-weathered friends like Bill talks about. When everything was going well, my friends were there for me. When it wasn't such fair weather and the storm came and Pat was, you know, caught down and out, everybody was gone. I didn't really have any real people in my life. I could summarize those 4 years by just partying. You know, I thought it was fun, but it was a private school. People were raised well. They took tests. They applied for college. They went off to college. I missed it. I just missed it. I drank and drugged it away. I didn't even fill out a college application. It was a private school. I was like one of three kids that didn't go off to college. It didn't even cross my mind. I was lost. 18 years old, you know, I guess a year after high school, living like a degenerate, my parents finally said, you got to get out of my house. And I did. It was a blessing to me. I couldn't wait to leave. I moved into a college town in New Brunswick, New Jersey. I was the only kid in the neighborhood that didn't go to college. I could summarize those next 4 years by, I knew the guy who owned the bar. We literally drank. One of my roommates was the manager of the bar, if you want to call it that. We literally drank from an hour before the bar opened until 2 o'clock in the morning when they kicked everybody out until, you know, 4 hours later, whenever we felt like going home. 4 years went by. During that period of time, I didn't have a job. I literally paid my rent by selling drugs. And there's a lot of people that are in this room, no big shot stuff, right? But that's what I did, and I thought I was really cool, and, you know, I can probably would have thought I was a tough guy back then, whatever the case may be. And by the time I was about 22 years old, all these kids that I had graduated high school with were now coming home. And these kids had a life. These kids were now getting jobs, and I was left like, what am I doing with myself? It was a riff. Anybody at that age just like feel like they missed life, right? Well, I'm here to tell you, at 22 years old, I look back now and I was just a kid. It didn't even start yet, you know, so it's okay. But I thought I had missed the boat, right? Life had passed me by. Everybody was growing up and I'm stuck. At that period of time, one of my other roommates, you know, he got in some serious trouble, man. And life showed up real quick, and it showed me the path that I was going down. This friend of mine, I was turning 21 years old. My friend committed inches and seconds, right? My friend committed a crime that he's still in prison for. This was back in 2003. Inches and seconds, I had a motorcycle helmet on a stolen motorcycle, and that's the reason the police didn't see me there. They couldn't get my face. Inches and seconds. One time I was on that motorcycle. It wasn't even my motorcycle. I would be probably sitting with that kid right there. Inches and seconds. He's gone. They threw me a 21st birthday. The next day, he turned himself in. Gone. Life showed up real quick. It was like, Pat, if you want to live this way, that's what you're staring down the barrel of. And all of a sudden, I wasn't so tough anymore, you know? And now I was really lost, because what am I going to do? And, you know, I still talk on the phone for a living at work, right? So somebody saw this ability in me. They had actually come down to Florida State, came back home, graduated college, got a job in Manhattan. They were working on Wall Street. They were selling stock. He said, you could do this. Now, I had a criminal record, but it was not, it had no felonies, nothing preventing me from doing this. Bullet point. I go into New York City. I stand on the floor of this Wall Street firm. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Like Bill W. said, I had arrived. Because I put like a few $100 in my pocket, but I was never going to amount to nothing. And here were kids 30 years or younger that had everything that I thought that I wanted, right? And I was going to do this because, don't forget, I had, you know, nothing going for me, right? And I did. And I tell you that story because the worst thing that could have ever happened for me happened during those next, few months. What happened was I put all the drink and all the drug aside because you needed a license to do this business. And I was able to put the drinking and the drugs aside just long enough to commit to something. Myself as an alcoholic, I know many others are very good at starting everything but finishing nothing. Well, I said that I was going to complete this, and I did. And I put the drink and the drugs aside long enough to complete this and get this license. And now I'm on Wall Street and I start to make this money. And like Bill also says, I forged a weapon that turned in its flight and would cut me to ribbons. That's what happened, because I was allowed to drink and I was allowed to do drugs so long as I produced. And what, you know, long story short, right? Long story short, I mean, in 2008, 5 years later, after what you would call a successful career, I had a mountainous drug habit on my back, which was no problem because I could fund it. In 2008, it was the financial industry and the market had crashed and the money was gone, the clients were gone, everything was gone, and there was no more money. And now it was like, holy shit. Like, I didn't have what it took to get that business off the ground. What happened was I realized that drinking and drugging was my full-time job and I needed to actually, like, be on the street and hustle it up to, like, make that lifestyle live, right? And that's what happened. And, you know, eventually, as a result of the things I did to keep that party moving, let's call it, I ended up getting more trouble and more trouble until ultimately I started getting a felony charge. You're not allowed to be in that industry, play with other people's money, and have a felony record. They took my license from me, and it was like, thank God. Because every day for, you know, the last year and a half, I put a shirt like this on. I could lie to mom. I could lie to dad. I could lie to the girl I was living with. Everything was okay. Even though I was a low-bottom junkie who didn't make a dollar and literally went to work simply so I had a safe office to use in and not get in trouble, I could lie to everybody and tell you that everything was okay. So when they took that license from me, I was gone. It was relief. Next 4 years of my life, from the time that I was, you know, that was in 2008 until 2012 when I finally got sober. That's when I realized that I needed to stop, wanted to stop, and could not stop. I am going to save you the gory details, but let me tell you that I have attended about 24 detoxes in those 4 year period of time. I had attended about 8 treatment centers. I commend all of you for even sitting in your treatment center, because by the time I was in my 4th, 5th, or 6th, I was the guy that was like, no hope, I'm out of here. Leave my bags at the door. Can't stay. Okay? I'm going to summarize it like this, because I only got about 15 minutes, and I want to talk to you about how I got sober. Let me just categorize Steve's one of my favorite one-liner kind of guys, too. He learned this saying of a bottom, his definition of a bottom, from a teenage girl in a psych ward somewhere in New York. From all places, this is where this came, and I relate to it. It said that a bottom is when conditions in my life deteriorate faster than my mind's ability to lower my standards, and that's what happened to me. When I was young and when I was, you know, first started using, I would clear cut, make a decision to break the law, and my mind was okay with the consequences. I made that decision to do that bad thing to you. Ultimately, what ended up happening was my life spiraled out of control so fast that I've done so many things. I'm not going to pour a fifth step out on the floor with you, but my mind was making decisions. The drugs were making decisions for my mind faster than I was capable of dealing with those consequences. It spiraled out of control, and it spiraled out of control fast. I'm going to summarize that by the time 2012 had came around, what would happen is I would pick up a white chip. I would pick up a white chip because I was at a bottom. I had nothing. I knew what it was like to have nothing. So where else do you come? You walk through the door of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you try to start over. That's what I would do. What really was driving me into the door is the fact that I only, the fear of living like that, right? And I just needed to get back on my feet. It was like an oil change. It was like a tune-up for me walking through that door, right? And the problem is that I had tried this thing so many times that what would happen is I'd be able to get like 30 days because I was in such fear of going back to the way I was living. Then I'd relapse, and then I'd come back. The next bottom would be so much worse that I'd put 60 or 90 days together. And then it would get so much worse that ultimately, before 2012, I was able to put 9 months of sobriety together, right? Because I was just so scared to go back to the way I was living. But after all those in and outs and in and outs and in and outs, I thought that when I walked in here, there was nothing being offered to me. I thought that there was no hope in this room. I thought that just don't drink, just don't go to a meeting. I tried that. It didn't work for me. Call me when you feel like drinking. I never did. I drank. You know, and so by August of 2012, I was on a vicious three and a half, 4 month run, and I was about 40 pounds under this weight that I'm at right now as a broken shell of a human being in every respect of the word. And, you know, I had a little bit left. And I'm the guy who knows what it's like to have nothing left, okay? I had a little apartment. I was about to get evicted from it. I had a piece of junk car. But it was about to get, you know, repoed from me because I had a loan out on the title for cash. You know, I had to park it down the road and everything so that they didn't. But I had stuff. And I didn't want to lose it, man. And I, you know, it was so pathetic, the end of that last run, man. I just locked myself in a room, dude, staring at myself in a mirror. It was emotional, man, because I had come off harder physical bottoms. Let me be the first to tell you, right? But the phone rang. It rang, and it rang, and it rang, and it rang, and finally I picked it up. I thought someone, like, died, man, and I'm a recluse when I'm out there. And I picked it up, man. No insurance, no nothing, and no, I got to get you help. You got to go to treatment. And I said, okay. I'd like to be able to tell you here today that I went to go to that treatment because I wanted to get clean and sober, that I thought I was going to get clean and sober forever. I didn't. I just didn't want to lose the apartment. I manipulated, I lied, and I cheated my way into treatment. Are you going to pay for the apartment if I go? She said, yeah. So you're going to pay for the car if I go? Is it still going to be back? She said, yeah. I said, cool, I'll go. Because the habit was bad, man, and I didn't have anything left to keep it moving. So why not? So I attended this treatment center with almost no hope on getting and staying sober. Where every other time that I entered, I could have put my hand on a Bible and swore to you up and down that I meant business this time and that I was going to do whatever it took. But I didn't do any of what it took. This time, I had lost hope and I wasn't prepared to do any of what it took. 10 minutes, 15 minutes. This is where God intervened in my life when I least expected him. Because with no hope or even attempt to really get sober, I stand before you a sober man walking into that treatment center. And what happened was there was always some divine force in the treatment centers that I actually kept that were keeping me to my seat, right? And that time it was a man in sobriety that was a teacher at that treatment center. And for the first time in all the years that I had been attending this, the 4 years or so prior to this that I had been attending these fellowships, I don't know if I ever saw anybody that was like really sober, and I just knew it without them having to tell me. I could just tell in this man's walk, in this man's talk, in this man's attitude that this man was sober. It was attractive to me. And it kept me there that time. And he didn't pound the big book down my throat, and he didn't, you know, he wasn't even aggressive about recovery. It was just, there was something attractive about it. And, you know, I ended up completing that treatment center, right? I told you that I didn't even want to get and stay sober. I had no intentions on even going to a meeting when I got out. I met a few friends. I didn't think I was going to have any friends in there. You know, I walked in. I introduced myself. They're like, tell us a little bit about yourself. I'm like, F all of you. I was like, I've been here so many times before. I know we're all going to be pals for the next 30 days. We're going to give each other our phone numbers. We're going to go our separate ways. And no one's ever going to see each other again. So I'm not going to bother getting in touch with any of you. One of my best friends, he's going to be in my wedding. He's still in that room. He was in that room back then. Another kid that's in New York right now, he's also was in that same room. He's going to be in my wedding. God just had different plans than the designs I had for my life back in 2012, okay? These kids were going to meetings, so I said, I'm going to go to meetings. I reached out. Some of you guys might have been here last week. This kid John spoke to a couple people in Miami, gave me a number of a guy in Fort Lauderdale. I called it out of my mind. I don't know why I called a stranger that day, but I called it, and he picked me up, and he brought me to a meeting. That meeting used to be the meeting that Teresa in the house with my sponsor. It was that Monday night, the meeting I now chair, and it was like something just clicked in my head. I don't know what it was, but something clicked in my head once they opened up the big book and started reading out of it. It was that the message that that man was walking with, not preaching, in that treatment center that I was attracted to was a message that was being directly translated out of the book in this meeting. And it hit me for the first time in my life that there is something to do around here and sobriety is attainable. And my sponsor, who now is my current sponsor, walked up to me in not such an intimidating way, in a completely different way than I ever could have imagined in all the years before. He simply walked up and said, would you like to read? My guard was completely down because it was a simple question. There was nothing fearful about it. Yes, I'd like to read. Like a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous, he put his money exactly where his mouth was. He said, not like, go read this and I'll see you in a couple weeks. It was like 8:15 sharp Tuesday, be at my house. Bam, had a big book for me. Okay, man. This is where the solution comes in, because that man took time. That is the one thing. They say selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem. I'm always too busy, right? So the one thing that I do is I take the time out like that man took out of his life. With years in sobriety and as busy as he is and as much as he had going on, 3 hours that first night that we met together. We weren't just reading the doctor's opinion and on our knees doing a third step like, get this kid out of my house. We started from page zero. I got an education. And I learned in that doctor, in that forward to the first edition, it said, the line that kept me coming back, because he never forced me to come back. He said, would you like to read again until we were finished with the program of action? Okay, would you like to continue? And the first session, in the foreword to the second edition of Alcoholics Anonymous, it said strenuous work. One alcoholic was vital for permanent recovery. And when I think of the word vital, I think of my heart beating, my lungs pumping. These things are vital organs. They must or I die. And, you know, permanent recovery. I never heard the word permanent recovery or 4 or 5 years of in and out. I didn't know that permanent sobriety was attainable. It's the goal. If you haven't heard that, let me be the first to tell you as well. Now, I am under no delusion that I'm going to be permanently sober. I believe that sobriety is obtained, like she said, at 7 o'clock in the morning when she woke up, 24 hours a day, based upon strictly our fit spiritual condition I have today. But permanent recovery is the goal. That kept me coming back until I read the doctor's opinion. And you would think that after umpteenth treatment centers and them telling me that this was a disease, that I knew what a disease was. I didn't. The doctor's opinion told me in black and white what a disease was, and it's been unedited in 1939. Basically told me that I have a disconnection from God, like it or not. That I am separated from my creator, okay? And because of it, I am trying to fill that void with another solution that's going to solve my problem. It comes in the form of a mental obsession. It tells me that I need to have a drink to feel better, that ultimately I buy into that lie, I have that drink, and what makes me, what makes us, if you identify as an alcoholic or an addict, is that we suffer from what's referred to as a phenomenon of craving. It's a physical allergy to alcohol. It means that once I take any whatsoever into my body, it's not a problem of the mind anymore. My body is different than other people. It has a reaction. I physically cannot stop drinking. I can tell you in those last 4 years and all of those white chips, an hour-long story as to what the sobriety period looked like, the lie that built up, the restlessness, the irritability, and the discontent that was going on in my heart and my soul that allowed me to create a story, a lie that I bought into that told, when I told myself it was going to be different this time, and I would say, okay, it's going to be different, and I picked it up, and then all of a sudden, I passed through, the phenomenon of craving develops, the doctor's opinion tells me that I passed through the well-known stages of a spree, that I emerge remorseful with a firm resolution to never do this, ever again. That was my life story. Put my hand on a Bible. Never going to do this ever again. Until I did it again. Over and over and over and over again. And it told me that this was going to happen over and over and over again unless I can experience an entire psychic change. And this psychic change couldn't be accomplished on my own thinking. It had to come from a power greater than myself. Great, sponsor, what do we do next? Move on. Now I've learned about my body and the fact that I have an allergic reaction to alcohol, and that once I start drinking, I can't stop drinking. We talked about my mind, and there's a solution, and it talks about things like, if hundreds of experiences have shown me that one drink means another debacle with all of the suffering, why do I take the first drink? I don't know, but that's my truth. And when you read it to me in black and white and I mirror it with my own experience, that's my truth. It tells me that I have special abilities, talents, aptitudes. It tells me that I build up a bright outlook for my family and future, but I pull the structure down over my head by a series of senseless sprees. That's my truth. My truth is that I can walk into the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, pick up a white chip, sit in treatment and eat well for 30 or 40 days, put the weight back on, grab a phone and I'll get the money up real quick and I'll fool all of you to thinking that I'm doing okay. But the problem is that I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, and my mind builds up a lie that tells me I need a drink to feel better, and I do it over and over and over again. That's my truth. So now he told me that I cannot do this on my own. I had to have God's help. After a lot of reading and a lot of work, we moved in to the program of action. And this is where he told me that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. I had to have God's help. Now picture, by the time I'm about to make this third step decision, I've sat with my sponsor for about 20 hours over a 2-3 week period of time, 2-3 times a week. I know full well what my disease is for the first time in my life after all of this attempts at recovery. And I know my truth, and my truth is that every time I tried to make a decision, I made a decision based on my own selfish needs. It placed me in a position to get hurt. And it ultimately led to my demise, to another lie, to another drink, to another bottom. So I had to have God's help. Whether God, the idea of turning your will and life over to the power greater than yourself scares you, I was educated by a sponsor as to my track record, my pattern, and what was going to happen ultimately to an alcoholic over and over and over again, and I bought into the fact that I was doing this based on my own self-will and my own selfish needs. It was comforting to know that I could have God's help. It wasn't forcefully turn my will and life over to God. It was like, I don't have to do this anymore. Thank you, God. What's next? So when you read the third step prayer, when I read the third step prayer, I had to be taught. I had to be educated. This is a body of work, and I don't have time. So 3 through 7 is a body of work. Steps 3 through 7, there's no amen on a third step prayer. I brought an invitation to allow God to come into my life for the first time maybe ever in my life. And what happened was I had learned that my own selfish needs had placed me in a position to get hurt over and over and over again. So I needed to find out what was setting the ball rolling. What were those selfish needs? The purpose of a fourth step inventory. I invite God in a third step prayer into my life so that he can help me and allow me to write fearlessly in a fourth step so that I can list all my resentments, all of my fears, my sexual conduct, and my harms to others. And it's very easy to sit there in a resentment inventory and be like, at them, I'm mad at them, blah, blah, blah. It's really difficult, though, to say, what was my part in that situation? And then in my fifth step, I was allowing my sponsor, the spiritual consent, for the first time in my life to have another man pick through my bullshit, because that's really all it is that goes on up here prior to entering sobriety. And to say to me, this was your part, that's where you're delusional, that's what your defect of character is, and that's what your wrong was, and that situation is what got you in. That decision is what got you into that bad situation that ultimately led to you drinking and hurting other people. And when we put all that on paper and I let him pick out my 6th and 7th character defects, I finally said to God, please, I don't want to be that person anymore. Because let me tell you what's happening as a process of reading pages 0 through this body of work in steps 3 through 7 is that ultimately, for the first time in my life, as a byproduct, I didn't even want to drink. All those other white chips, all those other institutions, and all those other rehabs, and what would happen is I would be white knuckling it, man. It was like my head would hit the pillow at night, and I'd be like, another day, I made it, you know, until I drank. Now when I'm going through this body of work with a qualified sponsor, it's like, I haven't even thought about drinking. So of course I have to recognize that God has helped me accomplish this. So now in a 7-step prayer, I say, please God, take all these defects of character from me. The metaphor is that I had a chalkboard full of junk piled up in my life, and the process of 4 through 7, I got a clean slate with God. He told me, now, you can't just be right with the power greater than yourself, you have to be right with the world, because you've done a lot of damage. I don't have time to tell you my damage, but the damage is bad. It's time to get right with the world. So then we took an 8-step, the 4th step, and made an 8-step list out of it, and it was time to get right with everybody that I had made amends to. And I don't have time to do the amends process with you. I could do a whole meeting on the 9th step. But believe me when I tell you that there were some that were difficult. There were some easy ones. And then there were some other ones, family members, that they still don't want to see me. She'll be the first to tell you. I'm writing letters to family members whom I've harmed, who are going to be out of town for holidays because Pat's coming home. Or is Pat going to be around? I've been able to make amends at this point to every single person that I've actually harmed up to date, and I get to keep it that way in my 10th step as we move into that. 4 through 9 body of work on a wrong. Sometimes I'll say to Billy, hey, Billy, how do you feel? And I feel bad about it because it's called a God consciousness. I've turned over a new way of life. I know in my gut when I've been wrong. The book calls it a God consciousness. So I take a quick 4th step inventory and say, what was my part? Why did I curse at Billy just now? What did Billy affect in me? Well, maybe he made me uncomfortable because he wanted to come over to my house and he pushed me and I didn't want to do it on that day and I was too busy. It was my wrong. It was my harm. I acted out because he was threatening something in my life. Now it's time for me to call Billy, not let that build up and build up and build up until I've made a mountain out of a molehill and then have an offense with her, an offense with him, and now I have 5 or 10 situations going on that ultimately I'm like, world's out of control. Drink. So a 10th step, I make amends to him promptly, and I go and I help somebody else so that my mind has shifted and moved in another direction. 10th step. 11th, I made conscious contact with this power. And 3rd, it's time to get close to this power. And 11th, prayer and meditation. I don't know where I'd be without it. And finally, I want to wrap up and leave time for you guys to share, but why are we here? We have, I said... in the beginning of the meeting, these two people have passed this week that are on my heart. Why did a 19, 20-year-old kid die from this disease this weekend? Why did Jerry, whom I love, who I've done my best to really, really help, why did he pass away this weekend, and why am I still here? Why did she pick up an 11-year medallion? Why are you still here? Were you inches and seconds away from death? Could a little bit this way or that way have had you in a different place today than in this room? Well, I believe that I'm here tonight because of the 12th step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe that it's my job to carry this message. And I believe that no matter how big and egotistical I might think I am on the outside, that I've accomplished this, that I've accomplished none of this. That God has done for me what I never, ever, ever could do for myself. And then he'll smack me down the sides and tell me the only thing that's important in your life, Patrick, is the fact that you're an alcoholic. And the fact that you have a relationship with me, and it is my obligation and my duty that has received this gift to carry it on to other alcoholics. I believe that's why I'm here today. I believe that's why all of you are here today. And that is how I'm going to close. Thank you.